This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A new disease, just like another epidemic would be, perhaps, maybe not the flu, but something else. And it would be a new disease. We would have to learn to deal with it.
At the direction of New York State, the Westchester County Health Department is ordering an estimated 600 people to self-quarantine for coronavirus.
Within a few weeks, the government might put limits on people gathering at big events like concerts or football matches. If large numbers of officers take ill, the police might only focus on serious crime and keeping order. The army could step in if they're overstretched. And all in all, one in five workers could be absent from work. No surprise then, the Bank of England governor admits it could hit the economy in a big way.
Prime Minister, are you telling people today that sooner or later, all of our lives are going to be disrupted somehow?
It is just, I think, too early to say.
To the Chief Medical Officer, what is your best guess, if you can, of how many people will actually get this disease?
It will not go above 80%, so for planning purposes, of course we go up to the highest rate that it reasonably could. But in reality, the proportion of the population who get infected is likely to be lower than that and probably a lot lower than that.
The virus is spreading. I'm under lockdown. They got a quarantine on the whole town. No face masks left from coast to coast. Running out of things folks want the most. As everyone stays home and waits to find out what might be their fate. It's 2020. The decade's just begun. With any luck, we just might make it to 2021. Reigning over, rioting mobs, tired of the lack of decent jobs. Without lives, people want to live. Something, it seems, had to give. Fascists looking for someone to blame. From India to Brazil, it's the same. It's 2020. The decade's just begun. With any luck, we just might make it to 2021. Bush all burning, towns destroyed, then the flooding, filling the void, left by the loss of the plants and soil. But they keep digging for coal, drilling for oil, as if the end times weren't right here. Just go shopping, do not fear, it's 2020. The decade's just begun. With any luck, we just might make it to 2021. They're miniaturizing nukes again, red button subs and orange men. Resistance grows on many lines, from rebellions to election signs. Yellow vests, austerity, billionaires and Bernie. It's 2020, the decade's just begun. With any luck, we just might make it to 2021. The virus is spreading, I'm under lockdown, they got a quarantine on the whole town.
That was American songwriter David Rovics. Find more and support David at davidrovics.com. He is our troubadour for the times. This is Radio EcoShock with a feature on the coronavirus, what you need to know and what you can do. With his daily briefings on the novel coronavirus, Dr. John Campbell has become a YouTube teacher for the world. Recently, John has appeared on radio from Germany to Australia. He is a man made for the hour, I think. John is a British retired nurse teacher. After teaching nurses in several countries, John got his doctorate on open learning for medical training. No wonder he draws it all out so professionally for hundreds of thousands of YouTube viewers. From Britain, Dr. John Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alec.
Now, speaking as we are in the first week of March, in a rapidly evolving scene, it's changing every day, what do you see as the outlook for this new disease in Britain?
Well, I think the chief medical officer in my country is of the opinion, and the prime minister is of the opinion, that it's overwhelmingly likely we're going to see more cases. Now, the big concern is what will happen is we'll follow patterns that have happened in China, Iran, South Korea and Italy, where the isolated cases became clusters. And the clusters went on from being isolated cases to clusters to community spread. This is the big concern. Now, community spread means that the virus is going from person to person, and we can't really follow that epidemiologically. We can't relate that back to a particular epicenter of the infection. So with community spread, cases of the virus will just pop up, and we won't probably be able to work out where they came from. And that means that we're kind of out of the containment stage into the delay stage, where we try and delay it for as long as we can. But that's unfortunately what I fear is going to happen, that we're going to see cases popping up as a result of community transmission. And this is likely to occur because of the fact that this virus is transmissible from people that are asymptomatic, that means without symptoms, or people that are pre-symptomatic before they develop symptoms, or people that develop only a very mild illness. And even though they have a very mild illness themselves, they can still be infectious and spread the virus onto other people who can subsequently develop a more severe illness.
What's the advantage to delaying it, though, John? Maybe we just let it run its course and get it over with.
What likely happens in epidemics is that quite a large proportion of the population will be infected. So the chief medical officer in my country estimates about 80% as being the upper number. The number of people that are likely to be infected in my country, and indeed globally, unfortunately, is likely to be 60 to 80%. Now, some of these will have very mild disease. Perhaps half of those will have very mild disease. But another half will have symptomatic disease, well, but bad enough to be off work sick for a few days. But a proportion of these, perhaps around about 12%, will have more serious disease that requires some medical treatment, such as giving intravenous antibiotics, supplementary oxygen, or intravenous fluids. Now, if it's 12% of about 30% of the population, that's actually an awful lot of people. And we would really struggle in terms of healthcare provision to treat all of those should they become ill all at the same time. So what we want to do is, we can't really stop it from spreading, but we want the people that are getting severe illness to be spread out as much as possible. So that gives us a much better chance of being able to give them effective medical treatment. Now, if we can give them effective medical treatment, that is going to reduce the overall case fatality, because effective medical treatment makes someone much more likely to survive a severe infection with the illness, a severe symptomatic illness, than they would without the medical support. We can't actually treat the virus itself, but we can do an awful lot of things to support people while they're critically ill. So we need to spread that out as much as possible. So what we don't want is a big peak of infections that goes up quickly, then will go down quickly. We'd much rather have a sort of slower, gradual bump so that we spread the infections out over a year rather than over just a few weeks. And then we'll be able to manage the situation much more effectively medically. And it will also mean that a much smaller proportion of the working population is off sick at any one time. So, for example, if 50% of the people that were going to get the virus got the infection in a 3 or 4 week period, as some models predict, then an awful lot of the workforce would be off sick at any one time. And, of course, that's going to include healthcare professionals as well. Whereas if we can delay it and spread out the amount of people that get the infection over a longer period of time, it will become much more manageable. So that's what we need to aim for.
John, it seems this virus is more successful in a contained community where it can create clusters, whether it's a cruise ship or a nursing home. I wonder, can a single virus infect us, in which case personal protection would be pretty unlikely, or does it take a certain load to enter our systems and cause this disease? What do you think?
That's a very good question. Now, this is a novel virus. It was only first identified in December. So normally, the likelihood of getting an infection depends on the number of viral particles someone's exposed to, or indeed the number of bacterial particles, but viral particles in this case, the virulence of that virus or bacteria, and the state of the host's defenses. So the infective dose of the virus is going to be different depending on the individual it's infecting and their host defenses. So, for example, someone with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease who is not able to clear sputum out of their lungs effectively, probably a relatively small number of viruses would be needed to infect those, because those viruses would not be cleared from the lungs by the cilia and the mucus and the coughing the virus and the sputum up. Whereas someone with a healthy respiratory tract, you probably need a larger number of viruses to cause the infection. Now, we don't know what the number of viruses is. In theory, yes, one virus could cause the infection if it gets down into the lower parts of the airways. In practice, I suspect we're talking about a larger dose than that, but those figures just haven't been quantified yet, and we don't know that.
Well, look, this sounds like a good opportunity. If you could explain to us where this virus goes in the lungs and how it damages our ability to live.
So a virus is what you call an obligate intracellular parasite. That means a virus can only reproduce inside a living human cell, in this case, a living human cell. So this virus is only transmitted from human cell to human cell. It cannot reproduce on its own like a bacteria. And a virus can only reproduce inside a human cell if it gets into the cell, if it has some way of getting into the cell. And the way a virus gets into the cell, this particular virus, there's something called a spike protein. And that spike protein fits into a particular receptor on the surface of our cells. It's the only way it can get in. It's a bit like putting a key in a lock. So the virus would be the key and the receptor would be the lock. And the particular receptor that the COVID-19 virus fits into is called an ACE2 receptor, an angiotensin converting enzyme receptor type 2. And these are found in the lower parts of the airways particularly. So there's not so many in the upper airways, but they're in the lower airways. The virus will lock onto these receptor sites. That will facilitate the entrance of the virus into the cell. After the virus absorbs onto this receptor site, the virus will go into the cell. And the virus will then start reproducing inside the cell because the virus will take over the genetic apparatus of the cell. That's what the viruses do. They hijack the genetic apparatus of the cell to force the cell to make new viral particles. Instead of making new cell proteins, it's making new viral proteins. And then after a period of time, those viruses will start budding from the surface of the cell. And they will bud into the lumen, into the hole down the middle of the respiratory tract, in the bronchioles, in the small bronchial passages. And that will get into the mucus, and that will be wafted up into the upper parts of the airway, where the virus will be shed by coughing and sneezing, and to some extent just breathing out. It's what we call a droplet infection. It's certainly a droplet infection. Now, the problem is that the virus, when the virus is reproducing inside the cell, eventually the virus will take over so much of the cell's protein-producing apparatus that it will kill the cell. So the virus itself can kill the cell. That means you start killing cells in the lower part of the respiratory airways. As well as that, when the cell is infected with a virus, viral particles will go to the surface of the cell, and the body's own immune system will actually kill the cells that are infected with the virus, again causing damage to the respiratory epithelium. Now, that damage has two effects. The first effect is the damaged respiratory epithelial surface provides an ideal place for bacteria to live, so we can get bacterial secondary infection, and that can lead to pneumonia. But as well as that, the presence of the virus and all this cell destroying that's going on leads to a lot of inflammation. And the inflammation causes the capillaries in the area to become leaky, and the capillaries will leak, and fluids will start leaking into the tissue spaces in the lungs, and eventually fluid will collect in the alveolar air spaces, the small air spaces over which gaseous exchange takes place. They will gradually fill up with fluid. And if the alveoli are full of fluid, that means the oxygen can't get in, and it also means the carbon dioxide can't get out. So the levels of oxygen in the blood would start to drop. That's a condition called hypoxemia. And the low levels of oxygen in the blood means there'll be low levels of oxygen to all the tissues of the body, such as the heart, the kidneys, the liver, the brain. That's called hypoxia. And the hypoxia will start damaging essential organs. And when these inflammatory changes cause the fluid to start accumulating in the tissue fluid in the lungs and in the alveolar air spaces in the lungs, that's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. So the mechanism of death will be, or severe illness will be ARDS, with the lungs filling with inflammatory fluid, bacterial secondary infection, which we can treat. And the other mechanism is viral pneumonia. So the presence of the virus in the lungs, again, will cause inflammatory changes due to the infection this time rather than due to the inflammation. And again, the alveoli will fill up with inflammatory fluid, and that will stop the exchange of gases. So basically, if you want to be put it fairly melodramatically, people will be drowning because the alveolar air spaces in the lungs are full of fluid. And the other thing that can happen is because the virus stimulates the immune system can release particular, the cells in the immune system can release particular chemicals called cytokines. And that can cause what's called a cytokine storm. And that presents as sepsis with a high respiratory rate, high pulse rate, high fever, high blood sugar levels, altered mental status, and alterations in the amount of white cells in the blood and increasing the amount of lactic acid in the blood. So that's another possible complication. So there's quite a few ways that this virus can get you if there is a severe infection, especially if it's causing these inflammatory changes in the lower tissues of the lungs and the lower airways.
Now, in Western countries, most of the people who have died are seniors, many with pre-existing conditions, as you mentioned. But are there cases where healthy people, even young people, can die from this disease?
There are. Now, the death rate increases greatly with increasing age. So the death rate is going to be higher in people in there. It starts going up in about the 50s. So people 50 to 60 are going to die more than younger people. People 60 to 70 are going to die more than younger people. And it goes up with increasing age until the death rate over the age of 80 is really quite high. Now, this is partly because as people age, the immune system becomes less efficient and less able to combat the virus. But as well as that, as people age, the probability that they will have other diseases as well increases. These are called comorbidities. So people in their 70s and 80s are much more likely to have heart failure, diabetes mellitus type 2, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, chronic renal failure, hypertension, and all these other diseases that are commonly associated with older age. And these comorbidities are also going to reduce the level of immunity that people have, making infection more likely. But as well as that, they're going to make serious disease more likely to occur with complications. So it's partly age and it's partly comorbidities. And there haven't been any studies so far that have dissected this apart. So whether it's primarily the increased case fatality rate is primarily as a result of increasing age or primarily as a result of the comorbidities isn't clear, but both are probably relevant. Now, your question about younger people being affected is, so far, the data that we have from China, now the Chinese have done quite large epidemiological studies on this now, and it shows the death rate in children seems to be much lower. Now, we're not quite sure whether the infection rate in children is lower, that the children are less likely to get infected, or whether it's children get a less severe form of the disease, or a combination of those two things. But we're certainly very grateful for the fact that this doesn't seem to be affecting children particularly. Now, this is actually in contrast to previous epidemics, such as the 1918-19 pandemic of influenza, where young people were disproportionately affected. This doesn't seem to be like that, so that's good. Now, you're right in saying that young fit adults have caught this disease. Perhaps the most famous case is Dr. Li in China, who was the original whistleblower who was suppressed by the local Chinese authorities and tragically went on to die from the disease when I think he was 33. Now, there was different factors there. He was certainly exhausted and extreme tiredness. And we know that lack of sleep can reduce the efficiency of the immune system. So that might have been a factor. It may well have been because he was working clinically, he was exposed to a lot of other organisms as well. So he may well have been exposed to influenza as well as COVID-19, for example. And if you get the two viral infections at the same time, then that's going to reduce the ability of the immune system to fight both of those to some extent. So it may be that he had multiple infections at the same time. So, for example, there was a case of a 35-year-old Thai taxi driver, I think it was. No, Thai retail worker, I think it was. 35-year-old Thai retail worker. And he was previously fit and well, but then he contracted dengue fever, which is a common virus in that part of the world. So he was already ill with dengue fever. But then he caught the COVID-19 as well, and it killed him. So it was probably the combination of the dengue and the COVID-19 that killed him. So generally speaking, younger people have a much lower case fatality rate. But it may be that if someone has multiple infections at the same time, that's going to increase the risk of fatality. Again, the precise research data on this has not yet been done to be able to pick apart exactly what are the risk factors in younger people. But if we take the whole younger age group, some studies in China, for example, have shown that people in roughly the 20 to 40 age group, their case fatality rate is about 0.2%, whereas that goes up progressively with increasing age.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are exploring the medical aspects of the novel coronavirus with Britain's Dr. John Campbell. And we have talked about clusters and this virus, and America has the world's largest prison system with about 2.2 million people in jails. And if the prisons get infected, the choices look bleak as far as I can see. The guards and support people will be reduced by their own illness and quarantines and workers staying home. I notice Iran temporarily, they say, freed 54,000 prisoners. And then we have army barracks and nursing homes and mental hospitals and more. Should we be trying to empty these places out? What do you think, John?
This has been a concern since the start of this epidemic, that there's going to be institutional spread. So such places as students' halls of residence, as you rightly say, prisons. Now, there was a case in Seattle recently where there was quite a large outbreak in a nursing facility for people with chronic conditions. And that resulted in high fatality because, again, you've got a lot of people living quite closely together. And there's been prison outbreaks in China and, as you correctly say, in Iran. So anywhere where people are living, especially indoors, and a lot of people in a confined area, there's going to be a greatly increased risk. So prisons in the United States are certainly at significant risk. If you get one or two cases in a prison, then it's likely to spread through the entire prison and infect maybe 60 to 80% of the people in that prison. So I think what we need to do is, I mean, certainly if you can reduce the density of people in the prisons, that would be a very expedient move. But if that's not possible, if the people have to stay in the prisons, then we certainly need very good regulation of people going in and out so that people who are potentially infected are not coming into contact with the people in the prison. But of course, that's very difficult to do because people can have a fever that then you might recognize that they're symptomatic and might be infected. But of course, as we've already said, many people get a very mild version of the disease and people can be infectious before they are symptomatic, before they're feeling unwell, but still spreading the disease. And one of the problems in the United States has been that testing has not been quite as on the ball as we would like it to have been. Now, I did notice that there's a political declaration today to introduce huge numbers of tests that can be carried out locally in the United States. But up until this point, testing in the United States, as I understand it, has been done entirely by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And there hasn't been a huge amount of testing done. For example, the Chinese are currently carrying out 1.5 million tests per week. The South Koreans have carried out 100,000 tests. The Italians have carried out 20,000 tests. But I think the total number in America is dramatically less than that. So cases have been missed in the States, and it's quite possible that, this virus could already be in prisons. I don't know that yet. But it's certainly a very high-risk environment, and we're going to need it to work out some way to maintain order. And it is going to be a problem, because, and as you rightly say, staff are going to be involved as well as inmates. It is quite a big concern. I think some political decisions may have to be taken.
Yes, the UK government just recently released a 27-page plan to deal with the virus, and I think they said there that 1 in 5 police may not be able to work, being either sick or in quarantine. Well, and they're planning on calling in the army if need be, but as we just discussed, the army themselves have to defend their own people.
Yes, indeed. My government have estimated that at the peak of the outbreak, 20% of the workforce could be off sick at any one time. So if 20% of the workforce are off sick, that's 20% of nurses off sick, 20% of doctors off sick, 20% of prison officers off sick, 20% of police off sick. So in the UK, we've said that the military will be available to backfill security issues and provide logistical support. And the government have said that the police would have to switch their focus from dealing with low-level crime to only dealing with serious crime and maintaining public order. But the military may well be necessary to maintain law and order. That is a possibility. Now, when there's difficult situations, this can bring out the best and the worst in people. So I think we really have to hope this is going to bring out more altruism than it brings out depravity in people. But of course, we do always have to account for people that will take advantage of difficult situations. And the military is certainly a possibility in my country, and I would suspect in the United States as well.
Yes, the Iranian medical system was already weakened by punishing sanctions, and now the BBC is reporting Iranian hospitals and morgues have been overwhelmed. What have you heard about Iran, John?
Yeah, I've actually had some emails from clinicians in Iran that have written to me at some risk to themselves. And weeks before the government, a couple of weeks before the government was admitting this, they did say there's a lot of cases in Iran and that a lot of people were dying in Iran and that it had been covered up. Because in Iran, there was particular problems. There was the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. There was, I can't remember this guy's name, the guy that was killed in a drone attack, the end period for his mourning period. The 40 days Islamic mourning period coincided with the same time. And people were coming and going and traveling quite a lot for the elections as well. So there was three things all happening at the same time, which all resulted in public festivals, all resulted in people traveling. My understanding is the government didn't want anything to interfere with these processes and interfere with the election. So there was an initial denial and cover-up, rather analogous to the Chinese situation. Now, my understanding is this has been rectified now. The government have realized now that this is a serious problem, not least because at least 20 deputies in the Iranian parliament have become ill themselves, as indeed has the health minister. There was that famous video of the health minister mopping his brow when he was trying to give an interview, and he tested positive himself the next day. And one of the vice presidents in Iran has also been tested positive and is ill with the condition. So Iran does seem to be improving now, and I was very encouraged to hear that there is a World Health Organization team on the ground now in Iran. And I understand they've taken 100,000 tests into Iran with them, as well as other medical equipment. But as you rightly say, the medical systems in Iran were already challenged, and some Iranians had difficulty accessing good quality health care as it is. And this has greatly exacerbated the situation. And this is going to be the case in many less developed countries. Another concern I've had from the start of this is that the pandemic, as I would now call it, spreads to areas with weaker health systems where we don't have the surveillance, we don't have the screening, we don't have the isolation facilities, and we don't have the treatment facilities. Especially in poorer areas where a lot of people are crowded together in relatively confined spaces, such as inner city slum areas. And the virus could spread very quickly in those circumstances, developing large clusters which could facilitate further spread to other areas. So it's a major concern in many poorer countries, and Iran is certainly a major concern. And as you rightly say, the services in Iran were already stretched due to external sanctions. I really hope that political differences can be put aside for the time being and we can really help the people of Iran. Because even if you don't want to help the people of Iran, which of course we do, but if there's a large cluster in Iran, that's going to spread to other places as well. This virus respects no borders. Helping one person is helping everyone.
Right. Well, the same. You have worried on YouTube about the fate of Africa with the poor medical system there. And people in the West may say, well, that's Africa. This is here. But we have millions of African migrants already on the move, and some of them are poorly fed in migrant camps right now waiting to come in. It's everybody's problem when this disease is on the loose.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about refugee situations where people are living in difficult circumstances, they're going to be more prone to infection because they're living close together in temporary accommodation. It's going to increase their vulnerability. Now, that's bad for those individuals. And of course, you know, as a civilized world now, we should aim to help all the individuals we can. But even interested self-interest would indicate that we have to help these people, because once the virus becomes established, the more people that have it, the more difficult it's going to stop. That means the more likely it is that I'll get it, that my children will get it, that your family will get it. So we have to try and curtail this epidemic any way we can to contain it and to delay it and to mitigate it.
Several authorities and pundits suggest this COVID-19 infection will just die down naturally as the weather warms up in the Northern Hemisphere. I think President Trump said that. Can we count on that, John?
We certainly can't count on it. As we've said before, this is a novel virus. Now, it's true that influenza viruses are much more prevalent in winter. Different reasons for that. Sometimes in winter, people tend to socialize more inside, so they're closer together because it's cold outside. Sometimes when it's cold, the blood supply to the nose is reduced. That can mean that infection gets in easier. And the other thing that's interesting is in winter, we produce less vitamin D. And we know that vitamin D is now involved in the immune response. So we know there's this big seasonality effect with influenza, both influenza A and B. The A type is the infectious type that comes from animals. Now, the seasonality of this virus is not known. Studies have been done on relative humidities on similar viruses that are analogous to the old SARS virus. And it actually showed that the virus survives quite well in low humidities and high humidities. We know from previous viral studies on viruses that were used to study the SARS-1 epidemic in 2002-2003, that the virus survived best at 5 degrees centigrade but on surfaces, but didn't survive for as long at 20 degrees centigrade, and probably only survived for a few hours at 40 degrees centigrade. But the seasonality of this particular virus is not known. And the reason I'm somewhat pessimistic about that is the virus has spread in places like Hong Kong, Singapore, which are warm. Thailand, there's also been cases, which, of course, are very warm places. So to answer your question, can we count on the spread of this virus going down in the warmer weather? Absolutely, we cannot count on that. Definitely not. We don't know what the seasonality of the virus is. We are hoping that it's going to spread less, but there's no particular evidence for that at the moment. It still seems likely that the virus can last for several hours to several days on surfaces, and that we can pick it up and contaminate our facial mucous membranes like the nose, the mouth, and the eyes with that virus, even after it's been on the surface for a few days. And in my country, it doesn't get that warm in summer anyway, usually. It might go into the 20s. But I don't think that's going to be enough to have a massive effect on the virus. So, no, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to help us too much. We need to contain and delay to spread out the severe cases. And of course, we need to give the scientists more time. The thing that's ultimately going to stop this virus is vaccination. We need these vaccines, but unfortunately, it doesn't look like a vaccination is going to be possible in 2020. It's probably going to be into 2021 before we get a vaccine.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. John Campbell, the retired nurse trainer from Britain, now reporting medical news on the novel coronavirus. If we get a reprieve in the Northern Hemisphere this summer, if that happens, could the same disease pop up again with new waves and new quarantines next fall?
pandemics often do have different waves. So, for example, in the influenza pandemic in 1918-19, there was a wave in 1918 and then a further wave in 1919. So that can happen. Now, I've just recently learned that there's actually this virus, this COVID-19 virus, has actually mutated. There's an S form, and now there's a, I think it's an LL form as well of this virus. What we don't know yet is if you've been infected with the S form, can you then be infected with the L form as well? So it is possible that there are some anecdotal cases at the moment of reinfection. So it may be that people could be reinfected as the virus mutates. But for epidemics to pandemics to follow waves would be quite a normal pattern for epidemics. And then the other risk, as well as the waves, is we don't know if this virus could become endemic, that it could be present all the time. So there's just so many unknowns at the moment. But yes, to answer your question, it's certainly possible there could be further waves of this virus, yes, or very similar viruses to it that have mutated from the original virus.
And you've also spoken about the after effects of being so sick, even for those who recover. I mean, things don't just instantly go back to normal for some people. And I would add the string of science papers I've noticed about the long-term damage in people treated in intensive care units, including people on ventilators, which extreme cases of this coronavirus often require. What have you heard about that?
Well, it's well known that ventilation is a very high-risk medical procedure. We only carry it out for the sickest individuals. And that, as you say, there can be long-term complications. But generally, if there's infectious diseases, there can be what we call sequelae, things that come after the disease. So after any viral illness, for example, there's going to be tiredness for a period of time. Very often you can get post-viral depression. You just feel down, sometimes for a few months after a viral illness. And as well as that, viruses can damage particular parts of the body. So, for example, there's a virus called Coxsackie virus, which can damage the heart muscle. Other viruses can cause scarring in the lungs, for example, and cause lung problems later on. Now, this particular virus, it's not quite clear what sequelae they might be. There is some data that some people get damage to the heart with this virus. So it's possible that there could be cardiac sequelae. And there's also some evidence that it can cause scarring in the lungs in some people, perhaps due to excessive amounts of inflammation. So there could be ongoing lung damage and shortness of breath after the virus. Now, whether it affects other organs or not, we don't know. There's some people believe it can cause damage to the liver, and some people feel it might affect the kidneys. But I haven't read any scientific papers on that yet. But the risk of sequelae with a virus is always there. But the Chinese data does seem to be showing that people can make a full recovery. Because what we have to always bear in mind with the COVID-19 virus is the epidemiological evidence so far indicates that 80% of people will have a mild illness. So 80% of people that have it have a very mild illness. They might be off work for a few days, but it's basically going to be mild and they should make a full recovery. And if you look on the Johns Hopkins website, the number of recovered patients is going up quite dramatically. Now, the Chinese started this, and their criteria for saying that a patient has recovered are actually quite exacting. The patient had to feel better. They had to have no fever for 10 days. They had to have an improving chest X-ray or CT scan, and they had to have two negative smears of the virus, showing that the body had cleared the virus. So it's actually quite a high bar for deciding whether someone was actually cured of this virus. So I would expect most people to make a full recovery and return to full health, but there could well be a minority of people, probably those who've got comorbidities or more severe disease, that do have longer-term sequelae of the virus yet, but the numbers of those have not yet been quantified. We would hope it would be fairly small.
So most of us should be fine, really.
80%, 81% of people should have a mild illness and make a full recovery. That is the current epidemiological thinking from the data that we have, yes.
So here in Canada, I'm a bit pessimistic. I feel we're miles behind. We have flights from Iran, Italy, and China still arriving daily. And when they come, the passengers are politely asked to self-isolate upon arrival. But We presume they take transit, they stay with families, some will not comply. I worry we're being too polite and that will lead to more deaths here. Plus, Canada, unlike Britain, has not published any plan, so we're all in the dark as to whether the government even has a plan. Have you heard much about Canada from your correspondents?
Not a lot, no, but I certainly think the government needs a plan because there's no doubt in my mind that Canada will not be exempted from this pandemic. It's going to go everywhere unless something changes quite dramatically. Now, throughout this, I've been very disappointed with governments and the World Health Organization and organizations like CDC in Atlanta for the lack of proactivity. They always seem to be reacting. So the World Health Organization would say, well, we'll stop flights to China if it becomes necessary. Even now, one of my chief health officers has said there may come a time in England where we need to stop shaking hands, but that time is not yet. I disagree. I think we need to be changing our behavior now. We have to be anticipating the virus because it has quite a long incubation period sometimes, and people are going to be shedding the virus in the incubation period. So I feel that a lot of governments and the World Health Organization have been reacting to events once they've happened, as indeed was the case to a large extent in Italy. But then you find lots of cases pop up because people have been incubating it and has been spread before the symptomatic cases developed. So I feel it's really time for Canada to start being proactive. I think you need to assume that the virus will be there in a few weeks' time and start behaving accordingly and taking appropriate measures now. And the fact that we're still doing so much international travelling just bemuses me, to be quite honest. And the fact that things are going on like mass participation events are still going on, it's almost like a form of denial that we'll start worrying about this virus when a lot of people start getting sick. But by that time, it's already spread. So the key thing is we need to switch from reactivity to proactivity. And that should be the mantra, I believe, of the World Health Organization and all world governments that are planning for this, because what greater responsibility does a government have than to look after the health and well-being of its people?
Well, and the word is always keep your hands away from your eyes and your nose and your mouth. And I had to go to Vancouver last weekend and help stock up my child with some food just in case there is a quarantine. And I tried on the way there and on the way back to just do that. And it's ridiculously hard to do. We have these habits that just keep bringing our fingers back to our face. I think for me, the only way that I could handle this is to self-isolate until this goes by.
Yeah, I mean, the other possibility, of course, is to wear gloves to remind yourself. Now, people talk a lot about face masks, but face masks don't actually provide very much protection from this virus unless they're very good quality face masks. So for most people that wear face masks, the main advantage is it stops you touching your face. So I think it's just a matter of getting into these good habits. Now, if we think about lift buttons and self-service checkouts and basically the screens and flat surfaces all over the place that we're obliged to touch, so I think when you've been out in a public area, when you've been touching surfaces, the key thing is to just really have some method of stopping you putting your hands to your face till you get home and wash your hands thoroughly. And you have to wash your hands in a particular way. So the health service, the World Health Organization, me, myself, quite a few people have put out videos on hand washing to show the proper way to do that. Because what will happen is the soap will actually mobilize the sebum on the surface of the hands, allowing the virus to be washed away. And as well as that, the virus has a fatty outer coat, and ordinary soap will dissolve that outer fatty coat of the virus, and that will kill the virus almost straight away. The other thing to use is hand gels. Strong alcohol hand gels can be effective as well. But as you rightly say, it's very hard not to touch your face because this virus will not get in through the intact skin in your hands. It's going to get in through the mucous membranes of the mouth, the nose, and the eyes. That's how it's going to get in. So perhaps wear gloves to remind yourself to not put your hands to your face. And then when you get home, take the gloves off and wash your hands very thoroughly, and frequent hand washing throughout the day.
and throw them out, bin them, as you say. You can't use them again. So Bill Gates saw all this coming. His foundation and Johns Hopkins even ran a simulated outbreak game last October where the threat was a coronavirus. Still, most of the world did not prepare, and America seemed like the least prepared. Personally, I wonder if this outbreak is really a test for something even worse in the future. Do you think a disease could reshape our economy and our social life?
The answer to that is very simple. Yes, absolutely it could. We live in a strange period where people don't die from infectious disease. But infectious disease has been a major cause of human suffering and death throughout the ages. If you go back into the Bible, you read about various plagues. In 1348, the Black Death, the bubonic death, arrived in my country, having spread through Europe and probably killed about 50% of the population. And we've talked about this pandemic in 1918-19 that killed perhaps between 50 and 100 million people globally. No one's really sure. Now, I'm not a specialist virologist by any means, but I've been teaching student nurses for 25 years now that a new viral pandemic is inevitable. It's not a case of if, it's a case of when. The virologists have been saying this for a long time. There will be further pandemics. And of course, we've actually seen this. HIV was a viral pandemic. And previous influenzas have been viral pandemics. But there's so many viruses in the animal reservoirs that there's possibility of this zoonotic spread from animals to humans of a novel virus. And if that virus mutates to allow human-to-human transmission, then pandemics are certainly possible. Now, it so happens that this particular coronavirus that we're suffering from now, the COVID-19, has relatively high transmissibility, but that's genetically determined, but has relatively low case fatality rate. We're not quite sure what it is. At the moment, it's looking like 1% to 3%. But there's another very similar coronavirus called the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, MERS virus. That's not as transmissible as this virus, but it has a mortality rate of about 35%. So in one sense, we could consider ourselves very lucky that although we've got a virus that's had about a relatively high transmissibility, it's got a relatively low case fatality rate. In the future, there could certainly be a virus that's got a high transmissibility and a high case fatality rate. It could be way, way worse, and it could happen in the future. And as things are now, it's taking about 18 months to develop vaccines for this. So there is always the potential for a viral pandemic. There always has been. We've just had a good run lately. We've had a lucky run for the last 100 years where there hasn't been a massive viral pandemic. But they have always been a risk and will continue to be a risk because the untold billions of viruses live in the natural world. They are part of the ecosystems, and there's nothing we can do about that.
As we wrap this up, John Campbell, is there anything else that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I think we need to act together on this. This virus is a common enemy. We need to fight it. We need to fight it as a combined humanity. We need to look after those that are vulnerable. We need to look after those that are sick. And we need to readjust our attitude, really, of how we are interacting with this world. If this acts as a wake-up call, that could be a good thing because we depend on the ecology of our planet. We cannot live independently of it. We need to live with it in harmony. So if that teaches us a little bit of humility about the frailty of human life, that it can be taken away by infections and other environmental things at any time, then maybe we'll walk more softly on the surface of our planet, and that will be a good thing.
From the UK, we've been speaking with Dr. John Campbell, the man who has trained nurses in many countries and specialized in online teaching as well. He's doing it now via YouTube. I check it out every day. His site is campbellteaching.co.uk, campbellteaching.co.uk. You can order his two books there. Thank you, John, for generously stepping up to help us in this hour of need and speaking with us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. There is all kinds of coronavirus news breaking all the time, but we need to hear this witness from 100 years ago. 1918 influenza pandemic survivor, Mrs. Edna Register Boone, was interviewed in 2008 in Mobile by the Alabama Department of Archives and History. It was recorded in 2008 when Edna was 100 years old. She tells us about surviving the last great pandemic to sweep humanity, words for the future as well as the past.
My name is Edna Register Boone. I was born in 1907 in rural Houston County, Alabama. We moved away from the farm when I was 3 years old and moved into the little town of Madrid, still Houston County. Times were troubled, a war going on, the flu epidemic that followed the boll weevil, three catastrophes right there. A new disease, just like another epidemic would be, perhaps, maybe not the flu, but something else. And it would be a new disease. We would have to learn to deal with it. I was 10 years old, and my family was the only family in the little town that did not contact the flu. Therefore, my parents became automatic nurses. They nursed every family in town, and one family in particular was outside of town limits. My father and Uncle Eli, whom we called his manservant, dug a common grave and buried three people in it, mother, father, and a young daughter. Unfortunately, we had no sanitary conditions in the area at that time, so the people were buried in the clothes they died in and wrapped in the sheets, because there was no way to wash the bed linens for them. So they were buried in a common grave. I do not remember a single church burial caused by the Asian flu. It was prevalent. If you loaded a sick person whom you could no longer help and put them in a wagon, which is what most transportation was, put them in that vehicle and take them to Dothan, to a hospital, that chances are that patient would be dead when they got there. Okay, if it wasn't, there would be no room. The rooms would be filled. The doctors would be worked to capacity. That's why most families just buried their own dead. The flu itself, the so-called, I think they called it the Asian flu, affected the throat and the windpipe and chest. And lack of medication. It was my job as a 10-year-old to take food to people, to families that were all of them stricken. Mama would put a gauze bandage around my face, and she kept sterilized fruit jars on the stove at all times. And she would fill those jars with soup or whatever there was. And I would take those jars to the home of an afflicted family, knock on the door, and leave the food at the door for someone to come pick it up. It was not a pretty picture. One thing I remember that my father did, there was an open space on one side of our house, I would say the west side of Papa, plowed up totally. I don't know what the measurement was, but I'd say fourth of an acre. and planted sweet potatoes. And I would say that half of the community lived off that potato patch because no one was able to go shopping. No one was able to cook. They could bake a few potatoes even if it was in the fireplace. I knew I had to participate. I knew that my family was being protected. I was raised in a Christian family. I knew I had to do my part. I came home one day, I don't know where I had been, but I came home and Mama was stretched out on a pallet in front of the fireplace. Oh, I panicked. Mama, Mama, are you sick? She said, no, child, I'm just so tired. I wanted to get as close to the fire as I could. She said, I knew if I got into that bed that I might not ever get up. We were like a great big family, you might say. I doubt if we had 200 residents. It brought families closer together, and it brought our little town closer together because we all suffered losses suddenly, say, within 3 or 4 days or some sort of epidemic sweep through. I think the only thing I could suggest about that is to be aware that it could happen again. Children need to learn about what could happen. Of course, I'm sure hospitals are aware. But the shock wave that sets in when something like this happens kind of stuns people, you know. They go beyond thinking correctly. And lots of times I would come in and I would cry because of all the sickness that was around me. And I knew that that sickness was deadly. It was depressing to me. Be aware. Be aware.
That was Mrs. Edna Register Boone from Mobile, Alabama, on her experiences as a 10-year-old in the 1918 Spanish influenza, which they called the Asian flu. Find links to pretty well everything in this show at my website, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Be well, and please join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Victoria, I can tell you that I'm shaking hands continuously. I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody. You'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands. And
how can they say a thing like that in times like this?
It's a free country.
And a free press, I may add.